One of the strangest tales told in Chuck Gunderson's two-volume book, Some Fun Tonight, is about psychic, famed psychic Jeannie Dixon. She made a prediction about the Beatles, said they were going to die in a plane crash. And of course, we know that they did not die in a plane crash in the 1964 during that tour. But Jeannie Dixon's prediction did come eerily close to happening, and we'll tell you that part of the story, plus how the Beatles were able to meet some of their idols, even though they were virtual prisoners during their tour. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Chuck Gunderson about his new book, Some Fun Tonight, two-volume masterpiece about the Beatles' tours of North America. One thing we haven't touched on, Chuck, about the times, I mean, JFK, the assassination, had just rocked the country the year before. In my mind, you know, I was just a little kid, but JFK and the Beatles are always going to be kind of entwined there. You know, the people could look at Beatlemania and say something was going on in the country, that this was celebrity worship run amok. But in other ways, the band was kind of a soothing balm for national wounds that ran kind of deep, at least in a couple of places, right?
A little bit, George. I mean, you know, the JFK assassination certainly did rock America. But now the newer Beatle historians that are coming out and writing about the Beatles are now saying that JFK, yeah, did have a good, you know, a mark on the country. But by the time Christmas rolled around, I mean, people were, and especially teenagers, were thinking about Christmas toys and what was going on in the hit parade and all that type of thing. And especially when January rolled around and I Want to Hold Your Hand hit, JFK was, you know, back on the back burner and the Beatles were on the front burner.
You do mention one of their top stops. I think it was Dallas, right? It wasn't on the 64 tour, but in Dallas, Dallas was still feeling the pain.
Yeah, they were. And the Beatles were a little nervous to go to Dallas. As a matter of fact, when they were traveling there from Kansas City on an overnight flight, John Lennon leaned over to one of the journalists who traveled with them on the entire tour. His name was Larry Kane. And he said, you know, is it going to be safe there? And when they landed, they saw a bunch of Dallas police, you know, toting guns and rifles. And actually, the motorcade went right through Dealey Plaza because they stayed just on the opposite of Stemmons Freeway at the Cabana Motor Lodge, which is still there today, not as a hotel, but as a minimum security jail.
I don't remember where the stop was or which of the tours. It might have been San Francisco, but there was discussion about a ticker tape parade with open-air cars, and I think that JFK had to be on their minds when that possibility was raised.
Exactly, yeah, and that's when George Harrison put his foot down. He mentioned when the Beatles did that landmark anthology history project, George mentioned in that, he said, that's when I put my foot down. I mean, he said, it had only been a few months since JFK was shot, and here they were having us go down the center of San Francisco in a ticker tape parade. He said, that's when I said, no way.
Tell me the story about Jeannie Dixon. Of course, we've forgotten her name. Much of the public's forgotten her name by now. But back then, she was hot stuff, a household name, and everyone knew her prediction. She made a prediction about the Beatles. Tell me what it was.
Yeah, so Jeannie Dixon was a really famous astrologer of the day. And, you know, in 1964 and 1965, Brian Epstein contracted with American Flyers Airlines to run the tour, and they got him around North America. And Jeannie Dixon came out with a prediction that when the Beatles were going to travel from Philadelphia on September 2nd, 1964, over to the next stop in Indianapolis, they were going to play the Indiana State Fair, that plane was going to crash. And that really unsettled the Beatles. And they mentioned to this journalist on the plane how nervous they were about this. And when I was doing research for the book, I came across this photo of their plane. They used two or three planes during the tours. And it was completely spread across the whole book, you know, this plane on the tarmac in Cincinnati. And I knew that one of the American Flyers planes had crashed in 1966. And I looked at the tail number, and it was the letter N, 183H. And, it was April 22nd, 1966. That very plane crashed in Ardmore, Oklahoma. It's still one of the nation's severest civil aviation disasters. crashed at Ardmore Municipal Airport. 83 people were killed, mostly servicemen. And that plane was being flown by its founder, Reed Pigman, and he died in the crash. So Jeannie Dixon was just a little far off by about a year.
Were you the first to make that connection, that that was the same plane?
I think so, because it was through the photographic evidence that I started to research this, and I was just astonished when I saw that plane sitting on the tarmac in Cincinnati.
You have some awesome photos from the tour stops. Of course, you mentioned Pigman. The band stayed at his ranch, I guess, right? There's some incredible photos of them wearing cowboy hats. It was just hilarious. I'd never seen them before.
That was just a crazy story, because Reed Pigman owned a ranch in Alton, Missouri. As a matter of fact, I'm just a few miles from there. I just finished up a huge Beetle festival that they have in Walnut Ridge, Arkansas, that kind of commemorates this event. So after the Dallas show, which basically ended the tour, they had one more show to do at the New York Paramount charity gig. And after the Dallas show, they got onto the American Flyers airline, and Reed Pigman suggested a little layover. The problem was is that he couldn't fly into Alton, Missouri with that big plane, so he had to pick another airport, which was close by, and that was Walnut Ridge, Arkansas. And it was a military base at the time, so you can imagine the town's surprise when they heard this big airline rumbling over town and landing. And, a few people went down there to see what the commotion was and realized, hey, this is the Beatles landing in Arkansas. After that, they transferred onto this little plane, and George Harrison called it a Buddy Holly experience. He said Reed Pigman flew the plane, and he had the flashlight in his mouth. It was nighttime, looking at a map with the windows fogged up. And they actually had to land on a wheat field in Alton, Missouri, which was highlighted by lit-up oil cans as a runway. And they spent the next 24 hours or so at the Pigman Ranch, riding horses and just generally relaxing. And then they came back to Walnut Ridge to fly to New York. Well, what was funny was that Paul McCartney and George decided that they would not go back on the little plane again, and they decided to take a Suburban back to Walnut Ridge. It was driven by someone else, obviously. And John and Ringo flew in the little plane back to Walnut Ridge. And by that time, all the town of Walnut Ridge knew that something exciting was going on, and they all turned out to see the Beatles arrive and get back on their plane and take off for New York City. It's quite an event.
Well, we're talking about celebrity worship and how, the price of fame, how success is a double-edged sword. You note in the book about that 64 tour, I mean, they had ideas that they'd be able to look around, see America a little bit, check out the sights, wander through hotels or bars or towns, and that just didn't happen. They were like prisoners, and I think probably that was true for much of the rest of their lives. But they were able to connect with a couple of their idols during the tours, one being Elvis Presley, another being Fats Domino. Tell me those two stories. It seems like, as you described them, both were a little bit awkward.
Exactly. Well, the first one was Fats Domino, because that's in 1964. So when the Beatles played New Orleans, I mean, one of their idols was Fats Domino, and it was arranged that they would meet Fats Domino in the trailer behind City Park Stadium, where they were going to perform that night. And Fats came down. He had this huge diamond encrusted watch. I mean, Paul McCartney still remembers that today, this watch. And they were so excited to meet Fats. And what's interesting was that Fats Domino always said that the Beatles came to meet him. He didn't want to come meet the Beatles. They were coming to meet him. And so they got to meet him there in New Orleans. The next year, on the 1965 tour, they met probably the man that got them into the business, and that was Elvis Presley, the king of rock and roll. So when they usually did the West Coast swing into L.A., when they did the West Coast concerts, they would always rent a mansion in the Hollywood Hills or Beverly Hills and stay there for 3 or 4 days. It was really the only rest they ever got. Well, on August 27th, 1965, the meetings of the minds took place between Brian Epstein and Colonel Tom Parker, and Elvis was staying there in Bel Air at his home, and they arranged a meeting with the four Beatles. So the four Beatles rode over there in limousines and went to his house, And it was just, now this is one of the events that's hardly ever written about. No photographs were taken, only a few from the outside when they were leaving, but nothing inside the house. When the Beatles arrived, Elvis was sitting there, obviously, and they were probably just awestruck. I mean, here they were, you know, seeing their idol that really got them into the rock and roll business. Here he is, sitting on the couch in living color. And there was an awkward moment of silence. They were just kind of staring each other across the couch and wondering what to say. And finally, Elvis said, "Listen, if you guys don't want to do anything or say anything, I'm just going to go to bed." And that kind of broke the ice. And, you know, from what I understand from the Memphis Mafia, you know, Elvis's kind of bodyguards and entourage, that there was a little bit of music playing. Ringo was playing pool. Priscilla was walking around and looking like a queen, and a lot of people kind of hanging around, but there's really not a lot of information exactly what went on during that meeting.
My gosh, that would be a heck of a little recording to have of Elvis jamming with the Beatles.
I would love to have heard it.
You know, they, of course, went on to become such prolific and successful songwriters, Lennon, McCartney, and then George Harrison, but in the beginning, they did a lot of cover songs. They did American songs, songs that, as you mentioned earlier, you know, with Bobby This and Bobby That had replaced, you know, rockabilly artists. Even Elvis had sort of gone away. And the Beatles really reminded Americans of the national treasures that we had from the kind of music that was no longer in favor.
Yeah, exactly. And the Beatles were masters at this. I mean, look, they grew up on American music. That's what really got them to be rock and rollers. They loved Little Richard and Carl Perkins and Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis. I mean, these were their idols. And the Beatles were experts at taking that music, and especially the music of Motown as well, repackaging it and bringing it back to America and really hitting the fans with it. And as a matter of fact, when they started the 64 tour, they opened up with an American song, Twist and Shout. They also had Roll Over Beethoven in there. They had Boys. And then they always closed the concert with that old Little Richard number, Long Tall Sally, which was the inspiration for the title of my book.
Yeah, it's the Some Fun Tonight is the book. It comes
tonight.
Out of Long Tall Sally, which was the last song they did at the last concert tour in America, right?
Exactly, and we even don't have a complete recording of it. One of the press officers, Tony Barrow, who was traveling with the band, Paul McCartney, came up to him on that last night on August 29th, 1966. He said, "I'd really like to record this concert." I think all of them knew this was it. This was going to be the last thing. So Tony Barrow had a cassette or a tape. He turned it on, and he forgot to flip it over because when Long Tall Sally was played, we only get about 32 seconds of it, and then it ends. It's really unfortunate.
You say that they all knew by then it was the end of touring forever, perhaps forever?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, from what I read and research and from the quotes that I read in the primary resources, by the time 1966 rolled around, they felt, hey, this was it. And Paul McCartney used to call it the lark of touring. The others were definitely fed up, John Lennon, George Harrison. I think Ringo enjoyed it, but he kind of even realized it was the end. You have to realize that a few weeks before that final tour started, in the first parts of August, that Revolver was released. And Revolver was just, like all their albums, was just completely groundbreaking. And with Revolver, you had, you know, background music or backwards music. You had Indian music instrumentation on it. You had, you know, classical instruments on it. There was just no way they're ever going to recreate this on stage. So, you know, what were they going to do in 1967? Just come back and repackage those same, you know, hits that they'd been playing in 64 and 65? No, the Beatles were progressive. And I think that's one of the biggest reasons they stopped touring, not only from the mania and people following and trying to get to them, but it was because the music had progressed so much that the technology wasn't there that they could create it on stage. And now Paul McCartney, with the technology, can do it.
McCartney, it seems like the last holdout in terms of wanting to continue, wanting the band to stick together, wanting to do more tours. And you see that, the rooftop concert. is that it was sort of like a last-ditch effort on his part to remind the band how much fun it was to perform together and perform for a live audience. And as I watched the footage of that performance, that little concert a couple of days ago, you can see him sort of trying to make eye contact with the other Beatles to say, "Hey, remember how much fun this is?" But eventually, it did not hold. I guess the problems of fame and then the problems of recreating the music itself became too much of a daunting challenge.
Yeah, but I think they always enjoyed their time on stage. I mean, so many people told me, like, oh, by 1966, they just didn't even care about the music anymore. They didn't care about the what they were doing on stage. And I don't know. I have to say something differently on that. And that is that, when the Beatles started their careers, it wasn't in a sterile recording studio. It was on the rough and tumble, smoke-filled, sweaty stages of Liverpool and Hamburg. And they loved playing music together. I mean, they knew each other so well. And I think even on the last concert stage they ever performed on for a live paying public audience, Candlestick Park in '66, that they had a good time. And even on the Apple Roof in 1969, they also had a great time as well. I mean, Paul McCartney used to say, "We were just a great little rock and roll band," and they were.
Your book is, I don't want to overkill my endorsement of it, but it's just a wonderful piece of work, and every page had something amazing, and the recreations of the photos and the memorabilia from then. But this book is expensive. I mean, when people go to your website and take a look at it, it costs a pile of money. It's gigantic, I should say. I think it weighs, what, 13 pounds?
Yeah, it weighs 13 pounds, and I decided to use, the extra thick paper and the spot varnish on all the photos and everything. But look, I mean, most of these books, and I've been in the Beatles, I've seen bought lots of Beatles books through my years. Most of the books of this quality range in the price of about $400 to $500. And George, the first thing I am is a Beatles fan, and I really tried as hard as I could to knock the price down as much as possible. To give Beatle fans this, extensive history of the three North American tours. And so getting it down into the 175 range, I felt, was about as best as I could do without, just barely covering my costs. Because first and foremost, I'm a fan, and I didn't want to charge anyone $400 or $500 for the two-set volume.
Well, it's sort of in the spirit of the band too. Giving the fans value, bang for the buck, was something they always insisted on in releasing their records, right? Like in the B side of their records.
Exactly. They were always conscious of that. Brian Epstein was always conscious of that. I mean, these guys were the hardest working band on the planet. No one can ever say these guys were slouches. And they did some amazing work in just a really short period of time. But most importantly, they gave the fans value.
I can't imagine what you invested in this and financially and how you'll be able to recoup what you've put into it. Maybe that's not important. I'm sure you'd like to get some of it back, but you'll be marketing this, I guess, for the next couple of years, right? As the anniversaries of each of these tour stops, the subsequent tours, happens.
Yeah, I kid to everybody. I go, "This is a labor of love," because it really is. It has to be a labor of love to do this. This is something I wanted to do. This is a Beatle book that I wanted to buy. No one was doing it, so I thought, I'm just going to do it myself. And, I do all the shipping of it, and, I'll sign my name in it, whatever you want me to do. And yeah, it's kind of planned because of all the anniversaries, and we'll have the tour anniversaries for the next 2 years.
Did you contact the remaining band members about the book, about would you contribute anything to the book?
I tried, and they're just so hard to reach, and I'm a self-published author, and who am I? There's other Beatle authors that are really important in the Beatle world that they can get to them, but I had to take the primary resources. I had to take the interviews they've done through the years and piece them together and try to figure out what their thoughts were and all that. But it's just extremely hard to do that.
I wonder if Paul and Ringo have seen it. Well, I'll let you think about that, and we're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll open up the phone lines, and you and I will chat some more as well. Chuck Gunderson, whose new book, Some Fun Tonight, is our topic of discussion tonight, along with Beatlemania. That song is Early Days from Paul McCartney's most recent album, New, a big hit. It's a sentimental and revealing song about the early days of the Lennon-McCartney friendship, sort of a response to critics who say they have some sort of insight into what the relationship was between those two musical giants, and Paul McCartney saying, hey, I was there, you weren't. McCartney's still touring, still selling out stadiums, still recording. Ringo Starr likewise. How long that will continue? Maybe Chuck Gunderson has an idea about that. We'll ask him, and then we'll go to the phone lines with your questions about his book, Some Fun Tonight. Stay with us for our final segment. We're in our final segment with Chuck Gunderson. Chuck, I got a message during the break from one of our listeners just telling me, hey, the girls went crazy because the Beatles were sexy, you know? Duh. Like, I guess I sort of sidestepped that. It's an obvious connection, and I think everyone would realize that. I guess you didn't want to think about girls that are 8, 9, 12, 13 years old thinking about sex, but I think that had to be part of the equation.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, look, these are all good-looking guys, and even I heard a story in Walnut Ridge this weekend when the plane was sitting there on the runway. One of the kids wanted to go over and see it, and the mother said, well, I'm going to take you over there and see the plane. Yeah. And, you know, you think of a mother as someone old, you know, but she was only 35 years old. Well, the girl told me that my mom went in and got all dolled up and went down there to look at the plane because she was hoping to see the Beatles, and they were hugely attractive.
Yeah, you think about these guys, how long it can continue. Paul and Ringo are still performing, still recording, still selling a lot of tickets. Ringo is talking about maybe having a Las Vegas residency. Paul is 72. He got sick, which caused some problems for his current concert tour, but it doesn't seem like they want to stop anytime soon.
I hope they don't stop. I mean, I think they're amazing at their age. I think they're better than anybody out there today. And anytime they're even near where I live, I'm going to go see them. I mean, these are the, you know, Mozarts of our day. And we're seeing them live, and I'm going to continue to see them. And I hope they never quit because it's something they love. I mean, why would you want to quit something that you love to do?
You know, I mentioned about the song Early Days, which is sort of McCartney's answer to some critics, like, or some writers, I guess, who've made up their own scenarios about his relationship with John Lennon. What's your sense of what it was like at the end before Lennon died? Had they buried all their hatchets? Had they come to some sort of an accommodation?
I'm not sure because I wasn't there, but you know what, George? I always like to look on the positive side of the Beatles. I really don't like to look at the negative. And even when doing this book, you know, even though the 1966 tour was marred with difficulties and controversies and things like that, it was still a fun time in America. I mean, people were going to these concerts and they were having a great time. They were eager in anticipation for the Beatles coming to their town. Town officials were eager for them to come. And it was just a general good time. And whether John and Paul were fighting at the end, I really don't know. But what I do know is that those guys loved each other, and they had great respect for each other, and they created some really good music together.
We started off 3.5 hours ago talking about the price of celebrityhood and the dangers of celebrity worship. I guess you could say that among all the celebrities that you can name is that these guys, the incredible power that they had, they have used it for good along the way. I mean, McCartney and environmental sensitivities and issues like animal welfare. I think Ringo was honored as Humanitarian of the Year for his charity work. John Lennon, of course, peace activists, and all of them concerned about racial equality. You could have done a lot worse, I guess, in how these particular celebrities used their power and influence.
Yeah, they were just a force for good. And, you know, in the end, you know, it's what they mentioned their whole career, and that is peace and love.
The love you take. Yeah, let's take a couple of phone calls. Wildcard Sharon in Creighton, Missouri. Hi, Sharon. Good morning. You're on with Chuck Gunderson.
Hi. Back in 1969, I lived up in Madison, Wisconsin, and the girl I worked with, she was a flaky but very smart hippie chick. And she asked me if I wanted to kind of hang out one day, and so went over to her house. And we were talking about music. That was one of the things we had in common. And she asked me if I liked the Beatles, and I said, yeah. I said, I love them. I said, they're one of my favorites. And she said, well, I've got some music. And so I thought she was going to pull out some records, and she reaches under her bed, and she pulls out these cardboard boxes, and she's got reel-to-reel tapes. And it turns out in the early 60s, she and her boyfriend, like hippies did, I mean, they just took off for England and Europe, and they traveled all over, and they happened to come on the Beatles plane at some small venue, and they started following them around like groupies, and they were taping their music, and she had all these reel-to-reel tapes, and I couldn't believe it. I remember just sitting there with my jaw dropping, and I've often wondered over the years, whatever happened to all of those tapes?
Well, Chuck, I'm sure you're salivating thinking about it.
Yeah, well, you know, there's so many things that we still don't know about the Beatles. Even 50 years later, we were having a debate today that when they played Kansas City on September 17, 1964, you know, did they sing the song Kansas City? Because their set list was tight. They never changed their set list. They sang 12 songs in 64, 12 songs in 65, and only 11 in 66. And some people say they did, and some people say they don't. We just we don't have any recordings of the music that as they played around North America to substantiate it.
Well, Sharon, if you could find your friend, those recordings would be not only worth a fortune, but important musical documentation of at a bygone time. Man, that would be something to find. I think.
Yeah, it would.
East of the Rockies, John in St. Louis. Hi, John. How you doing?
Yeah, good morning. I really appreciate it. I love the show, and I missed part of the beginning there. But I had a question for your guest. I'm a big Beatle fan, and actually I write songs, so I'm really intrigued by their songwriting craft, besides their celebrity and their music. But as a Christian, I've always been intrigued by John Lennon, you know, in his statement. You know, you read the whole interview on the Internet, and he says statements like he didn't know which was going to go first, Christianity or rock and roll. So then the last interview, though, that was the so-called lost interview for 30 years, the guy had it, and little of it was published, and it was published recently in Rolling Stone. And if you read it, he's talking about a gospel, someone asked him the question, the interviewer asked him questions about this gospel singer, singers who was there, and he gets into Christianity a little bit, and to make a few statements anyway. And the whole interview, he says Buddha one time, he says it's all good, we believe in everything, but he says Buddha once, but in that interview he must have said, I lost count, maybe 10 times Jesus or Jesus Christ, 10 times in one interview. And I just wondered, he had something, I don't know, he just seemed to have something against him, against that particular thing, and I think Yoko might have influenced it with her Buddhism. Did your interviewer, did your guest read that interview?
Yeah, I did, and you know, I'm not really sure of John Lennon's religious persuasions at the very end of his life and where he was sitting, but I do know that he was a force for good, and he did a lot of great things for people around the world and gave them a lot of happiness and peace in their life.
And you think about the song Imagine, which maybe was his biggest solo hit. I mean, those are pretty good sentiments. It certainly would not be welcome to the ears of those in organized religion, but certainly couldn't be construed as something that was evil or satanic or something like that. I understand your point, John. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. West of the Rockies, Larry in California. Hi, Larry. What's on your mind?
Hey, George. How's it going? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Great show. I'm a huge Beatles fan. I'm 53. I'm a musician, and I'm constantly telling youngsters and how influential the Beatles' music has been to everyone. It's like, it's incredible. But two quick questions, and I'll take them off the air of your guest. And the first question is, when they met Bob Dylan, I know John Lennon, it was said that John Lennon, he kind of really changed his whole songwriting style, that he kind of really took his songwriting, you know, a lot more serious, instead of like, you know, I want to hold your hand, he was trying to write more socially conscious songs. Is that true? And when the Beatles first came to America, a lot of people thought that it was the Beach Boys that they were bumping off the charts, but I heard that it was actually Frankie Valli and the Four Seasons that they were actually kind of like bumping off those charts there. And I'll take the questions off here. Great show. Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Larry.
Yeah, thanks for those questions. So when the Beatles first came to America, well, for the next tour in August of 1964, they'd been there in February as well. When they were playing the New York shows, which was at Forest Hills, they played the tennis stadium there two nights in a row. One of the nights, they were staying at the Delmonico Hotel in Midtown Manhattan, and Bob Dylan came by to visit them in their suite at the Delmonico. And as you know, they experimented with some marijuana at that time, and at that point they had good discussions, and yeah, the music, John Lennon especially, his music changed a bit, the direction, and added some songs in his repertoire which were Dylan-esque, and yeah, definite influence in John's life. And the other question was about the Four Seasons in Frankie Valli, and that was an ongoing debate, you know, is who's better, you know, the Four Seasons or the Beatles. And there's actually an album cover that says the Beatles versus the Four Seasons. And they're a great group in their own right. I mean, look, they've got a show on the Vegas Strip, Jersey Boys, you know, that kind of chronicles their career, now an epic movie. And, yeah, they were a great force in music, and the Beatles were absolute rivals with them, along with many other groups that were trying to eclipse them.
You mentioned about the Beach Boys. Chuck, you have in the book that they got to meet the Beach Boys at one of their stops during their tours, right?
Yeah, they met a couple of the Beach Boys in Portland in 1965, and the Beach Boys, a couple of them actually even drove up from L.A. To Portland to see them, and the Beatles couldn't even believe that they were backstage, and a meeting was arranged there. And then a couple of them also met them in Chicago in 1966 when they were staying there ready to kick off the 1966 tour. And in the morning, a couple of the Beach Boys demonstrated a new song to them, which was called Good Vibrations.
They were kind of like sponges. I mean, they picked up and learned stuff along the way. I remember reading about their friendly rivalry with the Beach Boys, Pet Sounds, and you know, how they would listen to each other's albums and do one-upsmanship. I guess they picked up things along the way. You know, India is another example. They were constantly reinventing themselves.
Yeah, they were, and that's what made them so fantastic. And you mentioned India. You know, when they started to do the some of the finger-picking songs, they learned that from Donovan while they were in India.
Let's go to our international line. Steve, is that Steve on the international line, or is that that's a previous line? First-time caller, Gordon in Oregon?
Yeah, they are. I had a rare opportunity to meet George and Ringo. But I was a Beatle fan from the time I first heard them at Indiana University in 1964. And 4 years later, I was a waiter at Del Monte Lodge in Pebble Beach when George and Ringo were staying there while John and Paul were over in India with the Maharishi. And then they met after that and went down to see Ravi Shankar. So the influence of the sitar or George Harrison at that time. But I had the opportunity because I was the maitre d' of the hotel. I would always get these special guests, and it was a secret that the Beatles, George and Ringo, were there. And I was selected to be their secret waiter. I was not to tell anybody they were there. I was not to tell anybody I was waiting on them. And I took a call early in the morning one day. I was the daytime waiter, and it was before we actually had opened the dining room. And they wanted some tea and crumpets. So I got all excited, and I rushed over to their room. And I was the only one there, and they were the only one there. And so I gave them their tea and got them to sign an autograph on the menu, and I still have that sign hanging on my wall, and went back to the kitchen. And, uh-oh, the phone rang. And turns out that, you know, they called before we had opened the dining room, and the water wasn't hot. So I get to their room, and they says, you know, the tea is lukewarm tea. So I had to rush them back hot water. And they said, well, you know, we're going to have to send over some tea from England. And I said, the last time you do that, we dumped it in the ocean. They laughed. They were very funny guys. I mean, they were very nice people. Like I said, I still have the autographs hanging on with the menu from Del Monte Lodge, February of 1968. And the sad part of the story is on February 18th, 1968, while I was waiting on the Beatles, my brother was killed in Vietnam.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear for your loss.
Well, Gordon, thank you for calling in and sharing that story. That was pretty cool. We're going to go to the wild card line. Richard in Wilmington, Delaware, try to get one more call in here. Hi, Richard.
Hi. Thank you for the privilege of being able to talk to your guests. I just had two quick questions for the privilege of being able to talk. Number one, what would have happened if maybe Ringo hadn't been dumped and maybe Pete Best would have just been on the Beatles in New York with Ed Sullivan? And number two, what was John Lennon's reaction when he went to see Stanley Kubrick when he was producing his movie 2001? I understand that John Lennon liked Stanley Kubrick and the movie 2001. He thought it was a really great movie. Thank you for the privilege.
Thanks for the call.
Yeah, so I'm not sure on the John Lennon story there. And the first question, George, was what?
About Pete Best. What if Pete had stayed
Pete
instead
Best.
Of Ringo?
Yeah, so, you know, Pete Best, a great guy. I've met him. I've talked with him. But they would have never went anywhere with Pete. Ringo was the best drummer in Liverpool. They wanted Ringo to be in the band, and they went and got Ringo to be in the band. And the Beatles would have never been the Beatles had it not been for Ringo joining the band. And, you know, your last caller mentioned, too, you know, about meeting them. And hearing these fans, you know, meeting them, that's just so, you know, special to me. I mean, it's so hard to do that. And we have to realize, George, that the Beatles as a foursome only stood on American soil for 90 days. That's it. You know, they came over here individually and maybe as a duo or whatever. But as collectively as a group, only 90 days they were here on American soil.
You know, I think about the music. I hear some young fans saying, that's 50 years ago. Who cares about that? But I know going to the concert, you see people of all generations, older than me, people of my vintage, and then young kids who seem to find something in the music. And you got to figure that 50 years from now, somebody will still be playing it.
Oh, I guarantee you 50 years, someone will be playing it, and someone will be playing it beyond 50 years. It's stood the test of time for now, and it will continue to stand the test of time. I have no doubt in my mind.
Any other plans for something to do with your book? It could be, I don't know, if you're going to turn it into other mediums, a film about it, documentary. It's just terrific stuff.
Well, you know, there's always these opportunities. The plan right now is obviously to, as a self-published author, to sell the book. And once we get that done, we can look at other plans and try to do other things. But yeah, hopefully some other exciting things will happen with the book in the future.
I'd asked you earlier about whether or not the two remaining Beatles had seen it. There's probably no way for you to know, but I would hope that if they did read it and like it, that they would send you a note. I wonder if that's how they operate.
I don't know that, and usually they don't do that. What I do know is that out of courtesy, I sent a book to their headquarters in London at Apple, and I do know through a third party that the chairman of Apple Records, Jeff Jones, loves the book. He thought it was fantastic.
Well, I do too, Chuck. Thanks very much. Chuck Gunderson, the book is called Some Fun Tonight. I hope you'll check it out. It's quite a piece of work. Thanks also to Dan Galante, Will Wilkerson, our webmaster, Sean, and to my earlier guest, Maggie Jessup. I'll be back tomorrow night. We have a rogues gallery of tough guys, real-life stories about bad hombres. Hope you enjoyed the show. I'll be back. Good night.